Let me say that, unfortunately, today's a really busy day, so I really wanted to be here earlier and to stay, but obviously it didn't work out. But I did want to say, before I speak, I want to say, or before I begin my remarks, I want to say that I spoke to my brother, Oscar Lopez Rivera, who actually is 68 years old. He just turned 68, has been in prison now, is going to be 30 years. And I was telling him that I was coming here, and he said to make sure that I bring you his solidarity from inside the prison, that he feels very strongly that people who resist obviously are the people who change and make history, and he wanted to definitely for me to express his solidarity to Joe and to everyone else here who is facing the grand juries and the FBI repression. So I wanted to make sure that I started with. I think that a few minutes ago someone mentioned Eugene Debs. As a matter of fact, he ended his speech that day with a quote that said something like this, that yours is not to question why, yours is just to do or die. And that's pretty much the idea of governments that are repressive, that want to send messages to people that obviously dissent is wrong. Well, I guess all of you here today and all the people in the world, including the courageous and glorious people of Egypt, have told the world that dissent is right, and that is the only way you can make change in the world. So obviously, Eugene Debs, by going to prison, proved that it was right to dissent, regardless of what he was told not to do. So let me just share with you briefly some, at least the salient aspects of U.S. repression against Puerto Rico and against the Puerto Rican independence movement. All of you probably know that the U.S. took over Puerto Rico in 1898 as part of the Spanish-American War, and that in December the 10th, 1898, the U.S. and Spain signed a treaty, the Paris Peace Treaty, by virtue of which Puerto Rico, the Philippines, Cuba, and Guam were ceded to the United States. And as a result of that, obviously, these islands became literally property of the United States. Now, the Philippines received its independence in 1946. Cuba, by virtue first of a pseudo-independence, the Platt Amendment of 1902, but we know that in 1959, Cuba really declared its independence. And so the last two possessions that are left are, in as a result of the treaty, is the island of Guam and Puerto Rico. The U.S. Supreme Court, in a case entitled Belzec versus the People of Puerto Rico, in 1922, declared Puerto Rico belongs to, but is not a part of the United States. Understand what the implications of that means. It means that Puerto Rico is a piece of property of the United States. Puerto Ricans were made citizens by an act of Congress in 1917, actually on March 2nd, 1917, a few months before the U.S. entered that war, which Eugene Debs denounced the First World War, and it needed to use Puerto Ricans as cannon fodder for that war, and it made us citizens. And the only two rights that Puerto Ricans have, even to this day, as U.S. citizens in Puerto Rico, is the right, obviously, to move back and forth from Puerto Rico without papers. And the other right is the right to bear the highest tax, which any citizen, which is imposed on any citizen, and now even on non-citizens, that is a blood tax, which is the right for you to die for your country, right? So given that, those are the two. Puerto Ricans cannot decide the fate of Puerto Rico. Let's make that real clear. Puerto Rico is a piece of property of the United States Congress. 100% of the Puerto Ricans could vote tomorrow to make Puerto Rico a state and nothing would happen. 100% of the Puerto Ricans could vote to make Puerto Rico independent and nothing would happen. It's up to the U.S. Congress to decide the fate of Puerto Rico. Given that situation, Puerto Ricans have resisted ever since the U.S. takeover of the island. But I just want to go up to 1936, when for the first time the U.S. government would use grand juries are against the Puerto Rican independence movement. And in 1936, the Secretary General of the Puerto Rican independence movement, a man who later on would become the national poet of Puerto Rico, and that our center is named after, Juan Antonio Correger, was given a subpoena to turn over all the documents of the Nationalist Party of Puerto Rico. He refused, and he went to prison for that. Later on, he would be indicted under a charge, which is very interesting, a charge called seditious conspiracy. It's a charge that has been used very little in the 20th century, but the greatest number of cases that it has ever been used are Puerto Ricans. It was used against Puerto Ricans in 1936 against the leader of the Nationalist Party, Pedro Albizu Campos, in 1936. It was used in 1950 against the Nationalists. It was used in 1954 against the Puerto Rican Nationalists. It was then used on and off in the 60s and 70s. It was then used in 1980 against the people who were accused of being members of the FALN, and in 1981 against my brother. So it has historically been used as a charge against Puerto Ricans. Interestingly enough, the laws read something like this: whenever two or more conspire to overthrow the legitimate authority of the U.S. government by force and violence. Now, the problem with that charge is that it's a conspiracy charge. It means that you don't have to do anything. It means that if an organization takes credit for any act, in this case the FALN, that took credit for several bombings, that whatever that organization does, every member is responsible for. Now, that organization could be an international organization. But conspiracy charges are very, very dangerous, and they can actually be used to jail a whole bunch of people. It was done in 1950. 1,000 Puerto Ricans were put in jail in 1950. And it has been used for many years against the Puerto Rican independence movement. That is the charge against my brother. Interestingly enough, you also have to watch the role of the press in this process. And just about 2 weeks ago, the Sun-Times of Chicago had an article on my brother's case, and obviously trying to tarnish Congressman Luis Gutierrez, who's one of the people that supports the release of my brother. And it basically went on to say that my brother was somehow linked to all these acts of violence. That in actual fact, if the government had been able to prove that, my brother would have probably have faced the death penalty. They were not, they had no evidence whatsoever to actually link my brother to any of those acts or any of the other Puerto Rican political prisoners, 11 of which were let go by President Clinton in 1999. And in actual fact, my brother was given at that time he was also released, given at another 10 years. He would have been out last year, but he refused based on the fact that two other people that had been arrested had not been offered given any offer, and he refused it on the basis that it had to be all of them or he was not going to leave. The U.S. government now, and particularly the FBI, has had an incredible campaign to literally retry my brother in the press in New York, all over the country where there are Puerto Ricans and large communities of support for him. And it should be no surprise to you that just as you use the press embedding them in Iraq and in other places where they tell the official story and really not the story of what really is happening, the same thing is true of many reporters in Chicago and all over the country. So obviously don't be surprised that in this case that you're facing, you're also going to face a lot of similar kinds of distortions of truth and toting of the FBI and U.S. government line. So I wanted to at least lay out the fact that the grand jury was used in 1936. After that, hundreds of Puerto Ricans, actually, since 1936, have been called before grand juries. Grand juries have continued to function in Puerto Rico, and it has never ceased, literally, since 1936, for grand juries to operate on the island of Puerto Rico and in the United States among the Puerto Rican communities. So let me just say that the only way, obviously, to confront this is always to be able to tell the truth. It is the possibilities, really, and anybody tried to speak truth to power. And I think that's what you're doing here today, and I think that's what's important. It's to be able to tell, as someone said, the story, and tell the story and the narrative the right way, not the way that those in power want to tell the story. And it's important that we use every mechanism in our disposal to do that. But it's also important, the possibilities of always, at least for me, I learned when I was called before the grand jury in 1976, and actually we kept out of jail for 11 months challenging all kinds of things, which we couldn't do anyhow, because there's really nothing you can do against the grand jury. But we used everything that you could imagine, the Fourth Amendment, the First Amendment, and we actually had a pretty nice judge, Judge Parsons, who was the only black judge, federal judge at that time in the Northern District of Illinois, and he didn't know what to do with us. But we kept him, 11 months, and then finally, I was told to go before the grand jury, and I went before the grand jury, and I said, look, I'm here because I am not going to cooperate with you guys. And in actual fact, you're sovereign. You should be running this, not this man, the U.S. attorney, who is the one that runs the grand jury. You don't have a right to an attorney. You don't have a right to a judge. No one in there. You're there by yourself. But it's run by the U.S. attorney. And so the U.S. attorney actually had gone to school with me. So it was a very interesting thing. They get into a debate. They threw me out of the grand jury room. Then they decided to call me back. And again, I began to talk. And then the U.S. attorney said, well, he hasn't taken the oath. And I said, I'm not going to take an oath. So then sent me back to the judge, and the judge says, well, actually, he doesn't have to take the oath. I think this is a legal precedent, actually. He doesn't have to take the oath because you can't tell a lie to a grand jury. So you don't really need to take the oath. So anyhow, I said, well, no matter what, I'm not speaking. And the judge tells me, Professor Lopez, I'm going to give you 10 minutes to think about your decision. And because, you know, you really have the key to your freedom. I said, Judge, I beg to differ with you. I don't need 10 minutes. I don't need an hour. I don't need days. I've made my decision. I am not cooperating and collaborating with this grand jury, which is being used literally as a weapon to literally destroy and create a chilling effect in the Puerto Rican independence movement. And then he says, marshals, take him away. And then I went to jail. So I spent 8 months in prison. But one of the things that I learned while in prison was the importance of having support in the community. And let me tell you, we had every week, and there are people here who can remember that, including that young man back there, who were part of a lot of these mobilizations. And I'm telling you that we went through, I don't know how many mobilizations, but every week almost we had pickets. And in actual fact, the U.S. government stopped using the grand jury for a long time against the Puerto Rican independence movement because it was ineffective. Even when they went a step further, which is if you're called before the grand jury the first time, you're charged with civil contempt. The next time that you refuse, then you're charged with criminal contempt of grand jury. And by the way, at that time, you literally could go to jail for good. I mean, people don't know that because criminal contempt, now it's a criminal charge. Civil contempt, you don't have a record. Criminal contempt, you got a record, and they can give you as many years as they want. Civil contempt, you only serve the life of the grand jury. I mean, you can be called again, but that's what it is. So in the Puerto Rican independence movement, they use criminal contempt against four of the people who had gone to jail with me. But it was interesting. I was expecting to be called also, but they didn't. And part of it, I believe, was the other people came from other parts of the country. And the thing is that here in Chicago, it became very, very difficult for them to call me again. And they felt we have to have something bigger than just continuing this thing of calling him before the grand jury. So I think the lesson there is this, that to the degree that you can build a movement, to the degree that that movement is deeply rooted in communities, to the degree that there are people that are there for you. I mean, I can tell you, I have been involved in the struggle to free Puerto Rican political prisoners for more than 45 years. And we have released four generations of Puerto Rican political prisoners. And so I am speaking from an experience of what is possible. And so I hope that that's the spirit that you take with you today. I want to end by recommending this book. It's Puerto Rico Under Colonial Rule. It's by two Puerto Rican professors. One is Ramon Bosque and the other is Jose Colon. These two authors actually have a wonderful story to tell about Puerto Rico, but particularly about political repression and the quest for human rights. So I really want to recommend it. Thank you very much.